Welcome to the Society of Construction Law Australia podcast, the podcast where we look at legal and technical issues facing the Australian construction industry. My name's Melissa Yeo, and I'm chair of the Society's Communications Subcommittee. The Society is pleased to bring you a recording of the paper delivered by Dr. Sean Brady at the Society's recent conference in Hobart. Sean's paper, entitled Complexity Theory, How It Can Help Us Think About Risk in Construction, is the third paper to earn a spot in the top three favorite papers of this year's conference delegates. Now, in addition to hearing it here, members can access a copy of Sean's paper, as well as the other papers delivered at the conference, on the Society's website, scl.org.au. Now, if you haven't already signed up to become a member, please ensure you do so, so that you can access these papers and receive updates about the Society's initiatives, as well as our upcoming 2023 National Conference. Thanks again for joining us.
So I want to talk about complexity theory. We could do a 10-week course on complexity theory. So what we're going to talk about today is just a tiny scratch of the surface to sort of introduce some of these concepts so that if we're interested, we can talk about them more in the future. But complexity theory really is a different way of thinking about systems and thinking about how risk works in systems and thinking about how things go wrong in systems. Before we get there, let's have a story. Some of you will have heard pieces of this story before. It's the 15th of March 2018. It's in Miami, and we're interested in this artist's impression of a bridge, which is a bridge that was being constructed outside the Florida International University. Pedestrian bridge. Looks like a cable-stayed bridge with its big pylon and those cables, but it's actually not. This span here is self-supporting, and this is what they built first. The cable-stayed nature of this is largely for architectural reasons, to make it look good. They got this far. So this is a site off the side of the bridge. So this is just off the highway where that main span of the bridge is in place. It's obviously sped up. It's a dash cam of a truck. What you're going to see is distressing. But as you see this truck turn out on to the freeway, you'll see the Florida International University Bridge in the distance. You'll notice the road is open and traffic is moving. And it happens very quickly. So this is the slowed down version. Have a look at the left-hand side of the bridge. Have a look at the crane, which is over near the left-hand side of the bridge. There's work happening at that side of the bridge. Keep your eye over there, because that is where everything happens. And it happens incredibly quickly, even when it's slow motioned. There was workers on top of the bridge, over near that crane. One of them was killed. What turned this into a real tragedy was that the road was open, the lights were red, and the traffic was backed up onto the bridge. It crushed cars and killed another five people in the cars. So it was a really horrific incident. And of course, since then, Miami's had its condo failure, so it's had its fair share of incidents over the last few years. What happened? This is a schematic of the bridge. A couple of things to take away from it. It's a pedestrian bridge. It's all made out of concrete. The top part of it is known as the canopy. The bottom is the deck. And in between, you've got 12 members, some vertical, but most of them diagonal, 1 to 12. And we're interested in this. We call it this 11-12 to deck joint area. So it's that deck joint at the bottom of that. And the reason why we're interested is, and this is taken from the National Transportation Safety Board investigation of the failure, we're interested in that member 11-12 deck joint connection because that's where the failure initiated from. So there was essentially an explosive failure of that joint. And you can actually see concrete blow out if you slow down the video. This is a truss bridge. All those members are really important in the bridge. If you lose one of them or if you lose one of the connections, you essentially have a mechanism. You don't have a stable structure anymore. That's what happened. Once you lose that member 11-12 to deck joint connection, you've got an unstable structure. You get very localized failures. You fracture the canopy at the top of member 11 and you fracture the deck at the bottom of member 10. And from that point forward, the bridge just hinges down. The right-hand side of this bridge is essentially undamaged. Those four members on that side are totally okay. To give you an idea of speed, it's just over 400 milliseconds it took this thing to fall down. So less than half a second for the bridge to come down. Why did it come down on the day? Well, they were doing some work on the bridge. This is obviously a still from a different camera angle earlier. You can see where the crane is, so you can orientate yourself from where you were looking at the dash cam earlier. There are men working here, and they're working at the top of member 11. Now, what are they doing? What they're doing is they're applying post-tensioning to the member 11 in the bridge. So the problem here is, in very simple terms, is concrete tends to crack when you stretch it. So one way you can stop it doing that is you can put some hollow tubes into the concrete, and you can put some steel rods inside those tubes and embed them in the concrete at the other end. And then you can jack that rod. You can squash up the concrete, tensile up the rod, squash up the concrete. That way it doesn't stretch and crack. And that was put in place for an earlier part when they were moving this bridge out over the highway, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. The problem was that they were reapplying this tension. So they had a big jack on top of this thing, and they were stretching those rods inside member 11. And the end of those rods were embedded in the concrete down here in that member 11, 12 deck joint area. What happened was that the stresses for that were simply too big, and it tore that joint apart. And that's why the bridge came down. Now, why were they post-tensioning this at all? They weren't meant to be doing that at this part of the design. Well, the reason was that this bridge had some cracks. And they took the view that if we reapply this post-tension that had been in the bridge earlier and then released, we'll close up all those cracks again and the bridge will be fine. Now, afterwards, the National Transportation Safety Board said this is complete rubbish. There's no way in the world you can crack up a section of concrete and then think that you're going to apply a tensile load to that and pull it back into one solid block of concrete. What actually happens is the opposite. Because it's so badly cracked, when you apply the tension, it doesn't have the strength to hold itself together. So it just tears itself apart. They were doing this because of cracks. What were the issues with the cracks? You know, all concrete structures crack one way or the other, and what we do is we make sure that the cracks don't get too wide. Once the cracks stay on the permissible widths, it's okay. The allowable crack widths in this structure were 0.4 of a millimeter. Now, if you want to know how thick 0.4 of a millimeter is, it's about the thickness of the nail on your little finger. So that's as wide as the cracks were allowed to get before you should get concerned. In the very beginning, this is the bridge when it was just cast. This is back in February, 3 weeks before the fair. It's sitting in the casting yard. They removed the supports from the bridge. It's the first time it has to carry its own weight. And they hear a cracking sound. It cracked straight up at that critical joint and a few other joints as well. Over the next 2-3 weeks, as they took that structure, moved it out over the highway and worked on it, the cracks grew and grew. So while they started off small, have a look at this. These were some of the critical members. Probably don't need to be an engineer to know that's a little bit bigger than the thickness of your nail. And these continued to grow over the 3 weeks. Have a look at this. Down the bottom, you can see the measuring tape. They've actually stuck it down into the crack because it's so wide. And they kept working and they kept the road open. Some of it was so bad that they were spalling concrete off the side of the bridge. Now, this is the actual joint here on the right that we're now going to go and put that massive tension into to believe we're going to close up these cracks. This is what it looked like. This is from the National Transportation Safety Board on the day of the fair. It was just riddled with cracks. One of the quotes from the report is that this was a bridge screaming that it was failing, but nobody was listening. And even though this was happening, they decided to apply the post tension to this, see if they could close up the cracks, and they decided to do it under live traffic. Oh, we could honestly talk for a whole hour on that. What was the fundamental problem? The fundamental problem, this is a member 11, 12 joint, and it's round the other way, so you just have to sort of get used to it. The issue here was that there was massive design errors made on this joint. Fundamentally, the stresses on this joint were dramatically higher in real life than they were on paper. The engineers just simply got it very, very wrong. What's amazing is that when the bridge started to crack up, nobody seemed to go back and say, well, let's check the calculations again and see if we got it wrong. Again, we could talk about loads of stuff here. What I want to talk about is that this design had to be peer reviewed. So an independent party had to come along and check that this bridge was fine. Somehow, in the course of this project, they got that wrong. So what we want to talk about for the rest of the presentation is how and why did they get that wrong. To look at the people involved in the bridge, there's Florida International University. They were doing the work with Florida Department of Transport funding, and Florida Department of Transport always had also had oversight on the project to make sure everything was done safely. Florida International University engaged MCM as the contractor for a design and build contract. MCM went and engaged a design firm called FIG. FIG then went and engaged the people who were going to do this peer review that we're going to talk about. They're called Louis Berger. And there was a few other people involved as well, a group called Structural Technologies. They were experts in post-tensioning. And another crowd called Bolton Perez and Associates. And they were essentially the client's representative in this. It was their job just to make sure everything was going right on the project. What's interesting about Louis Berger is Louis Berger gets hired by the designers to check their design. So an interesting little contradiction in there. But let's focus on why did Louis Berger not find these gross design errors in the bridge? And to try and answer that, this is where we can start talking about complexity, because complexity sort of gives us the tools to do this. So what do we mean by complexity? Well, it's not a particularly helpful name. It really is the study of complex systems, which I'm not going to argue makes it any easier at that point. But fundamentally, we know there's simple systems, and then there's complex systems. This has been around since the 1980s, huge amount of research done on it, ongoing on it. But fundamentally, there's some systems we just know are complex. We know that the economy is complex. And what do we really mean by that? We know that it's sometimes sort of predictable. It sort of does what we think it's going to do. And then sometimes it just doesn't. Sometimes it goes nuts. We have booms. We have busts. We find it really difficult to understand some of these things. We can understand afterwards, but we can't necessarily predict beforehand or see the signs something's going wrong. I would argue that when you get into big construction projects, you're probably in the same boat. We know construction projects don't go necessarily the way we intended. We know strange things happen. We know people behave in really irrational ways sometimes in these projects. How do we explain that? And that's really where complexity science starts to become really useful, because at its core, it's about how do you think about systems? Think of a construction project like a system. There's a group of components, which are the parties, and they're all going to interact with each other. It's a system to deliver something. How do we think about systems? Because it turns out that we human beings are really, really terrible about thinking about systems. And there's one reason why we're really bad at it, and that is we love what's called Newtonian thinking. Now, that sounds like a nice scientific and an engineering term, Newtonian thinking, but all the lawyers in the room will be pleased to know that you do this too. We all do this. So what is Newtonian thinking? Well, it really came from Isaac Newton, as the name suggests. He did lots of things. He gave us calculus. He gave us an understanding of gravitation. He gave us equations of motion. But he also gave us a way to think about things. And that's Newtonian thinking. And there's a few bits of it that are really important. One is it's deterministic. What does that mean? It means that we can work out the equations about how something works. We can work out where everything is, and we can now use all that to predict where something will be. We can get a mechanical understanding of something. If we want to understand where the planet Jupiter is in their fortnight, we can sit down and work that out. We can determine where that is according to Newtonian thinking. It's causal, and this is a really important point. We believe with this sort of thinking that small causes have small effects. Big causes have big effects. And we do the same backwards. If we get a really big bad failure, we say, well, the cause of that must have been terrible. But what we find in some of these systems is little things make the big difference in these complex systems. It's not necessarily big causes, big effects. But in Newtonian thinking, it's very, very linear. If someone dies on a construction site, it must be really bad what caused that fatality. It must be so much worse than what would cause an injury. But we know that's not quite true. And the last piece, which is critical, is it's reductionist. Now, what does that mean? It means that the way we tend to understand problems is we say, if we want to understand a system, what we do is we break that system down into its components. We understand what each of those components are actually doing. And once we understand what each component does, we know how the system works. In other words, by understanding each of the components, we understand the system and we can predict what that system will do. Another way of saying this is that the system is the sum of its parts. And I would argue that probably most of us in this room tackle understanding things in exactly that way. And not only, as I said, is this in science, but it's broke the barriers of science and it's pretty much in how we think. It's the backbone of management theory. So if you go and look at how we're meant to manage firms and run firms, we use Newtonian thinking. We used something that someone worked out to describe the behavior of how planets move to work out how we should manage people. As someone said, that'd be a lot harder if each of those planets could think for themselves. But we do believe fundamentally that the world is predictable, rational, measurable, and controllable. And I would say that when we set up construction contracts, we think about them in those terms. When we think about how those contracts are executed and how people do the work, we think about it in those terms. But we know that doesn't necessarily work. It doesn't necessarily work because Newtonian thinking doesn't work in complex systems like construction projects. And the problem here is this reductionism we talked about. It's the belief that we can take something and reduce it to its components, understand the components, and therefore we understand the system that's the problem. Because in complex systems, we can't understand them by understanding only the components. A really good example of a complex system is an ant colony. Now, ant colonies are incredible what they can do. Here's a bunch of ants using their own bodies to build a bridge so the other ants can run across the top of them to carry food. How does this system work? How do they work out how to do this? Well, we'll never figure out how they do this by catching one ant and studying the hell out of it. Another good analogy that I really like is, if you want to understand how your garden works, you're not going to really understand your garden, how your garden works if you run out there with a net, capture every species of animal and plant, and pin them to a board. You might know a hell of a lot about all of the animals and plants in your garden, but you still don't understand how your garden works. There's some systems, complex systems, where this reductionism simply doesn't tell you anything about how the system works, but that pulls against our human need for understanding. And the reason why this doesn't work is that there's something about complex systems that when we break it down to the components, we lose the magic of what makes that system work. We lose whatever it is that drives that system. We can take a car, break it down into all its components, and because it's a relatively simple system, we know how that car works. The minute we break these systems, we pull the ants out of it and study the ant, we've lost the magic of the system. Because complex systems display what's called emergence. Now, we could spend literally 2 days talking about emergence, and we'll only scratch the surface. Some people say that what makes a complex system is that it displays emergent behavior, like those ant colonies. So what is that? It means that the components of the system interact and produce behaviors that were not designed into the system. Your Newtonian thinking tells us we can design that system to work like a machine. Complex system says, no, you're going to get this emergent behavior that you didn't design in there. Another way of saying this is that complex systems are more than the sum of their parts. Now, if that doesn't hurt your head, you probably haven't understood it. And this is a quote by Don Farmer that I really like. He says, what does it really mean to say that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts? It's not magic, but to us humans with our crude little human brains, it feels like magic. Somehow, by constantly seeking mutual accommodation and self-consistency, groups of agents or components manage to transcend themselves and become something more. Focus on the words, seeking mutual accommodation and self-consistency. This is what drives this emergent behavior that we see. There's multiple ways we could tackle it, but have a look at this. Anyone know what this is? This is starlings, and it's called a murmuration of starlings. And what's incredible about this is you've got loads of birds who are flocking. And flocking really means is they fly in some sort of self-organized pattern. And decades, scientists tried to study this to say, how do they do this? How do they actually produce this behavior? Is there one boss bird? How does this actually work? And it's only when you sort of go to complexity science, you start to say, well, how does this work? Because you can say, why don't we try and build a model of this? I mean, I'm an engineer, we need a model. So you can go and build a model. And imagine we've got the world here, and imagine when a bird flies out of the left, it comes into the right, and when it goes up the top, it comes into the bottom. So this is all wrapped around each other. And we can put 501 starlings in there, and we can point them in random directions, put them in randomly, point them in random directions, and say, go for it. And they don't do anything particularly interesting, because they're not interacting with each other. We've got our components in here, but we don't really have a system. And quite recently, a scientist by the name of Reynolds came along and said, what happens if we give these starlings some rules? Not overarching rules like Newton would give them. Why don't we give them little local rules about how they interact with the birds that are right beside them? And he came up with three rules. And the point is, there's only three rules. Alignment. The birds tend to turn, so they're moving in the same direction as nearby birds. Separation. They won't bump into each other. They'll get close enough, but they won't get close enough to hit each other. And cohesion. They'll move towards other nearby types of birds. So think about that. Three really simple rules that you wouldn't imagine will do much. And they're all local. That's the key thing. This is not being governed by a construction contract, for example. And we can start them off randomly like we did before. And then we can basically switch on the rules. And we can watch what starts to happen. And remember, these are just three very, very simple rules. But as you watch, the random behavior starts to drop away. We still can't predict what's going to happen. We still can't predict where any bird will be at a particular time. But we start to see emergent behavior. We didn't tell them to flock, but those three simple rules produced an emergent behavior known as flocking. And we can put the real ones and the fake ones together, and I've tried to get them to the right speed. But very quickly, you start to see the same type of behavior. And the key thing is here, it feels like if we were to write the local rules for these birds, we'd have to write incredibly complex rules. We don't. And what complexity science tells us is a couple of very simple rules between agents or components in a system can produce very, very different behavior than you thought you were going to get. And by this stage, they have absolutely organized themselves into flocking from three simple rules. And we can look at how segregation works in cities, and we get the same sort of thing. We can look at how bubbles and bursts happen in the economy. We get the same sort of thing. And what's happening here is that one, the fundamental difference between simple systems, like a car or even an airplane, what makes complex systems complex is the interactions. And of course, Newtonian thinking tells us we can ignore the interactions, but the only thing that matters in the system is the components. That's why Newtonianism and reductionism fails. That's why how we mostly think about systems fails, because we have to look at the interactions. If we want to understand systems, go to the interactions first. They will have a much bigger impact on the overall outcome than the components themselves. So, with that in mind, let's go back to Florida and look at how some of these concepts play out. As I said, there's so much we could talk about on this bridge, but let's go and have a chat about Louis Berger, who didn't do a good job on the peer review, who didn't pick up that there was an issue. So let's look at the interactions in the system that Louis Berger were working in. So Florida Department of Transport, we know, had oversight here. Because of the way the funding worked for this bridge, they said, we need a peer review. That was all very standard. Peer review is you go and you independently do your own calculations. You check that the design of the bridge is okay. Totally independent. And the scope is non-negotiable. You use what is the Florida Department of Transport's plans preparation manual. So the scope is set. It seems really good, doesn't it? What could possibly go wrong if you're a Newtonian thinker here? What went wrong was that these duties get handed over to MCM, as we know, who hand them on to FIG. So now it's FIG's job to come up with a third party to do the review. And they have to do this as part of the tender process because they're going to get into a hard dollar contract with MCM. So who do FIG pick to do the peer review? Any takers? It's not Louis Berger. They themselves, yes. So they say, well, why don't we do it themselves? That'll cost less. More money in our pocket, but let's make sure another office actually does it. Fast forward a few months. Of course, they priced the job based on that assumption. Fast forward a few months. There's a meeting. FIG happened to mention that they're doing the peer review themselves. Florida Department of Transport hear this and they go, no, you're not doing it yourself. You're going out to get independent people to do it. And of course, this has caused a problem because now FIG have to spend money they didn't think they were going to have to spend. FIG put out their request for bids, and this is where Louis Berger enters the picture. Louis Berger says, good news, we are pre-qualified to do this work, but you had to be pre-qualified with the Florida Department of Transport to do it. We will do it in line with the scope and the plans preparation manual, and our fee for this work will be $110,000. So FIG have got one bid for $110,000. They didn't just get one bid, they got two more. And when they got two more, they realized they had a bit of a problem. Now, if you're FIG and you're under pretty severe financial pressure now because you're in this contract with MCM and you're spending money you didn't have to spend, which of those do you reckon you'd like to pick? The 63. And remember, the scope stays the same. There's no scope negotiations here, but this is all plans preparation manual. Louis Berger seemed to have got nervous. We know before it was awarded, Louis Berger came back. They stressed that their bid, just for comparison purposes, was very thorough, that they were going to develop independent models of these structures and they were going to use these independent models. And they said, look, before you make a decision, make sure you give us an opportunity to come back with your best and final offer. We don't know what happened next, but very soon, the bid of $110,000 disappeared and was replaced, quite miraculously, by $61,000. So again, because of these interactions, the bid price goes down to 61. The 10-week timetable to do it goes down to 7. And FIG reminds them, just remember you're still doing it in accordance with a set scope, set out in the plans preparation manual. So nice and cheap, but same amount of work has to be done. Just think about that interaction and the behavior that interaction is going to drive. What do you think Louis Berger did? And I'm not apologizing for Louis Berger here in any way, but by understanding these interactions, we see suddenly why people start to behave the way they do, for better or for worse. In this case, decidedly for worse. Louis Berger, one of the things they have to do is they have to check each stage of construction of this bridge. Stage two is when this thing is brought out and put over the highway, transported over the highway. Stage three is when the backspan's put on to the end of it. Stage four is when they tie up the pylon and the cables. Louis Berger, don't check this one. Don't check this one. Only check the bridge in its final state. And as we know, the bridge never got to its final state. Not only did they not check all stages of construction, they also cut another corner. They have to check that all the parts of this bridge have been designed properly. They checked the members. What did they not check? The connections. And of course, that's where the gross design errors were made. Once they didn't check those connections, those designers got to make their way through the design and construction process. What's interesting is when you go and look at the research of what causes failures, this is some work done by the Dutch in 2014, but they went through a spate of structural failures. You can't do an engineering presentation without one graph. The point here is that the taller the bar on this graph, the more important it is in terms of preventing a structural failure. If you look over to the right, you'll see technical competency and the human factors. When I talk to engineers, they say the single most important thing is to make sure you're technically competent. That's how you stop failures. The research shows something quite different. Yes, technical competency is important, but it's not as important as communication and collaboration, and it's not as important as risk allocation and control mechanisms. The interactions in the system are what govern whether you're likely or not to get a construction failure. And we tend to ignore them. If you really want to stop these sort of failures, we have to stop looking at these as individual parties who may have done something wrong and start saying, what is the interactions that we build into the system with our construction contracts? And even apart from the construction contracts, what are they going to do to be mutually self-sustaining, to work out what's mutually best for everyone, because that's how they're going to actually behave in the contract. So the interactions set in the contract is one thing, the interactions in real life is another. The key lesson, if we want to manage risk in these sort of projects, is sure look at the parties, but go at look at the interactions you've built into these contracts and ask yourself, what does that really mean? And when people come up with their own way of doing it, what will that look like? Thank you very much.